attending a cabinet committee. And the deputy minister as well, attending the same cabinet committee. Okay, and Dr. Luyenge, Honorable Kekana, and Honorable Nyambi, they are serving in other committees, so they won't be able to be with us. But otherwise, I see other members are here. Honorable Edwards, I'm told, has asked to be excused at half past 8. 10. Okay. All right. No, it's fine. So we are ready to proceed. We're in a venue that was very cold yesterday. Today, very hot. I wonder what's happening here in Parliament with the air conditioning. Climate change. Yeah, no. Darren, can you get somebody to... They're coming. All right. Okay. we concluded yesterday with ESCOM. Yes, my apologies, with the SASOL presentation. We said that we might still engage in some other issues that were raised yesterday during the course of the discussion. But I wonder if I'm told there is an inquiry from SASOL whether we'd want to finish first with them before we get to ESCOM. But I think if there are any specific comments that you want to make, I can make them. But otherwise, if you are still around, we can take the presentation by ESCOM, have Q&A, and then towards the end, I guess members can comment on the rest of the issues raised during the two-day workshop. So if you are still around, I think we'll finish early today. So, yeah. Are you fine? Okay. Welcome, delegation from ESCOM. I think I see new faces. Can you introduce yourself and then just take us through your presentation?
Good morning, Honorable Chair and members of the Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs. My name is Christopher Nikak. I'm the Acting Senior General Manager for ESCOM's Technology Group, and I've got with me Deirdre Haps. She's the Environmental Manager, ESCOM Environmental Manager, and Maluta Mbeti, who is a Senior Advisor in our Air Quality Research Section. Chair, I will start with a short introduction, and then after that I'll hand over to Deirdre and she will take us through the presentation. I think we need to start off by saying that ESCOM is committed to achieve compliance to all environmental legislation. And since the early 80s, we have reduced our particulate emissions significantly from 5 kilograms per unit send out or per megawatt hour send out, where we're currently running at less than 0.3, in fact, year to date at 0.27. kilograms per megawatt hour send out. Over the last 3 years, we've spent 6.8 billion rands on our emissions compliance capital investment. around about 50% of that was spent on Medupi Kusile, and the other 50% was spent on our existing fleet, retrofits as well as operational issues. And we obviously foresee that our expenditure on air quality compliance over the next decade will continue to increase. And in fact, we see a significant increase in capital investment required to meet our compliance requirements. Now, while we've made good progress around reduction of our emissions, we are obviously very much aware of the impact that the emissions from our power stations have on people's health. And it's also for this reason that we've started some time ago what we call an air quality offset program. And I think in the presentation we'll see a little bit more detail around that. And the intention with that is to address the conditions of our atmospheric emissions license. And as I've indicated, we are quite confident that this is going to have or is having already a significant impact on improving the air quality in the communities that's affected by Eskom. Before I hand over to Deirdre, who will take us through the detail, I just want to, you know, reconfirm and recommit that Eskom is committed to continue reduction of our environmental footprint and impact, and will continue to do so in future. So, Chair, with that short introduction, I'm going to then hand over to Deirdre to take us through the presentation.
Thank you, Christo. Morning, Honourable Chair and members. Thank you for this opportunity to present today. I am going to give an executive overview to start with. I think it's important to say that we do support the minimum emission standards. I know that there were some questions from the members yesterday about commitment. We are committed to the minimum emission standards. We really believe that they are important in order to address the harmful effects of health. And I'll talk a little bit towards that and how we hope to contribute to the improvement in air quality. Our power stations generally comply with the minimum emission standards. If I say generally, Dr. Kencross gave us some figures yesterday in his presentation. We do have upset conditions on occasion, and I went back last night and just double-checked what our status was last year and this year. Last year we operated, we've got 90 units, so every unit has a limit and every unit must be remain within compliance, and that's just on the coal-fired plant. Last year we were in upset conditions for 2% of the time. And this year-to-date, we are in 0.2% non-compliance. So when I say generally, I say mostly we are in compliance with our emission limits. And it is only on occasion when we have upset conditions or breakdowns that we have a spike for a day or so where we may go over the limit but then bring it back very quickly. So, and that's on the particulate emissions. Historically, we were only required to reduce particulate emissions, so we are much further down the road in terms of reducing our particulate emissions, but our power stations were not fitted with technology to reduce sulfur dioxide and NOx. And in that area, we have still got a journey to travel in the next few years. Because of this, we've adopted a phased approach, and I'll talk about why we adopt a phased approach later on in the presentation. We've been operating an ambient air quality network for in excess of 30 years from Eskom. So some of our more recent monitoring stations are required in terms of our atmospheric emission licenses, but we voluntarily operated ambient air quality network for a very, very long time prior to being required to do so by legislation. And that gives us a good feel for where we're at in terms of ambient air quality. And I think a lot of that information contributed to some of the information that was presented by the professor and by the Department of Environmental Affairs yesterday. And then lastly, our air quality offset program, we believe will address domestic burning, which, as we saw from the professor's presentation yesterday, is one of the main contributors to poor ambient air quality. So this is just an overview of the presentation. I'm not going to go through each of those. But then to just start with the next slide. Who's operating? Oh, there you go. Thank you. You can go to the next slide. So this is our current status as we sit now. Obviously, where we show, if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see that we have our two new build power stations. We only have three of those units commissioned and commercially operational currently, and eventually there will be 12 units at Kusile and Medupi. And then our existing fleet of coal-fired plant, and then we also refer to separately our return to service coal-fired power stations, which were brought back specifically to address the capacity constraints that we experienced from 2007 onwards, and those are Camden, Fruit Flare, and Pumati. And then lastly, our peaking stations, which are liquid fuel open cycle gas turbines. And what you see there is mostly a green picture. Currently, we are only in non-compliance at two of our power stations, and we did speak about this, it was spoken about yesterday, at Medupi and Matimba, where we exceed our sulfur dioxide emissions of 3,500 several times a month. So we have these, we mostly are below the limit, and then a few times a month we exceed the limit. And it's basically a spike up based on the coal quality we get, and then it comes back to normal. So in those two areas we are currently in non-compliance with our Atmospheric Emission Licence, and we have submitted a postponement variation request to the authorities to increase our limit to 4,000. The other stations that show in white to sulfur dioxide, oxides of nitrogen, they are in compliance with the Atmospheric Emission Licence, but many of them do have postponements in place, and that is why they are fully compliant. If you go to the next slide. What we can see from 2020 to 2025, again, in terms of sulfur dioxide, there's a lot of green there, and that is because those stations already have postponement applications which are valid until 2025. And then we've indicated the stations which will be retrofitted in that period. So Medupi will be retrofitted with FGD, and three of our power stations will be retrofitted with low NOx burners, and our particulate matter, we would be implementing technologies to lower it even further at six of our power stations. You will see we are in non-compliance. We continue to indicate non-compliance at Matimba. That is pending whether we will get approval from the Department of Environmental Affairs or not. And obviously that determines whether we continue operating the plant, because we can't operate in non-compliance. And then on the NOx emissions, we will need to ask for further postponements in 2018-2019 for the power stations that are reflected in red in the middle column. And those are some of our older power stations that are reflected there. And then post-2025, we obviously do not have any postponements in place. So if you can go to the next slide, sorry. And so then you can see a much more negative picture, and we will be relying on postponement applications in terms of sulfur dioxide, but you can see from our particulate matter perspective, we are in full compliance except for Kumati, which is our oldest power station, and may be operating much lower loads by 2025. So the next slide. Yeah, I think it's always important to talk to where we have come from, and to show that we have been committed to reducing our environmental impact and reducing our emissions for many years. When the old APA Act was in place from 1966, we started implementing retrofits from 1982, and you can see that we reduced our emissions, as Christo presented in his introduction, from 5 kilograms per megawatt hour sent out to 0.2 kilograms per megawatt sent out. So a significant reduction in the amount of particulates that we put into the atmosphere. And then you can see all of those little flags are as we retrofitted the various power stations. You can see in the last about 7 years, we've kind of evened out in terms of our particulate emissions, and some of that was impacted by the load shedding and the constraints on the plant, in that we didn't have as much opportunity to maintain. But that will, you'll see a sharp decline in that as we start with the retrofits, and I'll show you how we've reduced the emissions at Crusoe on its own, but we'll start seeing that coming down in the next couple of years. Can you go to the next slide? And this is the slide of Crusoe's particulate emissions, and we've completed the retrofit of fabric filter bags at Crusoe. We completed that about 2 months ago, and you can see that we have significantly reduced the particulate emissions from Crusoe. The last unit came off in February for that outage, and once that unit came off, all of the units were operating with fabric filter plants, so we brought our emissions way below the 2020 limit and not just the 2015 limit. If you go to the next slide. So the next slide talks to our gaseous emissions, our sulfur dioxide and NOx, and that really is the improvements, or the decline in that is only related to the generation and the actual megawatts sent out. So you can see from the NOx emissions there is a slight improvement that is definitely related to the decline in use of our using our coal plants for generation. It also relates to NOx abatement that we've put in at Camden Power Station. Half of Camden Power Station is retrofitted with low NOx burners. Now, that wasn't in our official plan, but what we do have as a policy is that when we have to replace burners, we will replace them with low NOx burners. So Camden needed a replacement of burners, and we therefore have replaced them with low NOx burners. So some slight improvements on the NOx emissions. On the sulfur dioxide, you can see that we haven't had the same kind of decline related to the generation or from the power stations. And the reason for that is that while we have reduced the generation from some of our older plants, we've increased the generation from the Medupi plant. And Medupi, as you know from the previous slide, operates with coal that has got higher sulfur. So the benefit that we got from reducing operations at some of our older plants has been negated by the additional generation at Medupi, despite Medupi also having low NOx burners. Important to also show what our long-term plan is, and we again just reiterate that we are committed to reducing our emissions. Our particulate emissions, you can see, will come down significantly in the next 5 years, up until 2025-26. Our sulfur dioxide will reduce mainly due to the Medupi FGD, and we'll talk a little bit about that and the cost of that. And then our NOx emissions will also reduce as we implement in the next 5 years our low NOx burners at Tutuka, Majuba and Matla. Go to the next slide. This is an important picture, and I think was asked for by the members previously. So what you see is a list of, on the left, a list of all of our power stations. Then you can see the retrofits that are planned for the power stations. And in the middle, you can see the years that those retrofits are planned for. So you can see that they start at different periods, but all of the retrofits that we will be implementing from now, and well, actually from 15-16, which was the start of first lay, which is now complete. And then the next station is Letaba, which will be putting high-frequency transformers and doing some refurbishment work on their electrostatic precipitators. I think also interesting in this picture is that we showed the decommissioning dates if you assumed a life of 50 years or 60 years. Now, there's not a determined 50 or 60 years decommissioning date. It really is a decision that's based on economic principles, on what the demand is, etc. And we base that, obviously, on the integrated resource plan, what the demand of electricity is, etc. So you can see if we base it on a 50-year, some of our oldest stations, such as Arnett, Andrina, Cameron, Fruitland, and Komati, would be decommissioned in the next 5 or 6 years. That has not been confirmed, and they're more likely to go towards the 60-year life, which you'll see the 60-year life dates on the very right-hand column. So that's just showing how we're doing retrofits in all the plants that will definitely continue operating beyond 2025, and then there's less work being done on those stations that will be decommissioned in the next 10 or so years. On the next slide, I think Sasol also presented a very similar slide yesterday on the implications of implementing flue gas desulfurization. We just wanted to talk about some of the estimations that we have based on the flue gas desulfurization plant that's been implemented at Kusile, because Kusile is built with FGD, and then we are quite far down the line in terms of quantifying the cost of FGD for Medupi. This picture is based on 3,600 megawatt plant, which is our Kendall Matimba plants. Medupi is 4,800 megawatts, so significantly bigger. The units at Medupi are 200 megawatts bigger than a Kendall unit or a Matimba unit. So the estimated capital costs are 25 to 28 billion rand. There is an estimation from Medupi that the FGD at Medupi will cost between 30 and 40 billion. We obviously will need additional water for this. There is sorbent or limestone that's required, and at least 400 tons per power station that would have an FGD plant, and then operating costs of approximately 300 million rand per annum, and that is just for one power station, it's not for the whole fleet. And obviously the outputs from that and the benefits is that we will reduce sulfur dioxide and NOx and the particulates. There is, however, a waste product called gypsum. We anticipate that where we are close to market like Kusile, we will be able to find a market and use that waste, although perhaps not all of it, but increase the market in terms of gypsum. And then the other side of it is that the efficiency of the plant decreases. There's an increased use of electricity due to the operation of an FGD plant, which means that you would emit more CO2 per unit sent out. If you go to the next slide, these costs are based on what we've agreed with the authorities in terms of our retrofit program and our emissions plan. So the first block that you'll see is the current emission reduction plan up until 2025, which will achieve a 57% compliance. Obviously, that's averaged out across the three pollutants. So we are seeing that we would have a 99% compliance on the particulate matter, except for Komati Power Station, but on the sulfur dioxide and the NOx, it's a much lower percentage. So this is an average across the three pollutants. What that would cost us is 63 billion, and that is for FGD at Medupi, low NOx burners at the three power stations, and retrofitting of ESPs and upgrades at 4.5 of our power stations. We say 4.5 because Duva already has fabric filter bags and operates at 2020 limits, but the other half has got electrostatic precipitators, and we would have to address those three units. In our postponement application, the authorities requested in the Atmospheric Emission licenses for Matimba and Kendall that we also start developing the FGD for those plants. If we add the FGD for Matimba and Kendall in this next 10 years, it will bring the cost of the retrofit program to $79 billion. If we were to today, which is almost physically impossible, to implement FGD at all of our power stations and low NOx burners at all of our power stations, then it would be a cost of about $300 billion. So that is the cost as in today's RAND. If you start looking at it over a period of time when we actually could implement, that $300 billion obviously increases due to interest and CPI, etc. I think important are the two bubbles on the right-hand side. The plan as we have it now would have an impact of 3% on the tariff. And if we were to go for the full compliance immediately, if we were able to do it right now, then there would be an increase of 10% on the tariff. And that is seen as a pass-through in terms of the tariff. So if the increase in tariff would obviously be passed on to the customer, the consumer. I think important, the little star at the bottom, in our next application to NERSA for tariffs, so the application that's being considered at the moment is just for 1 year. We will be submitting the NYPD4 as far as I know, next year for the next period. And these costs over the next 10 years are obviously subject to NERSA approval. So what our plan is for the NERSA application is to actually ring fence the environmental cost in the application and ensure that we do get approval for statutory compliance in the NERSA application. If you go to the next slide. Not a problem, is it thinking? So Chair, this is just another table that talked to some of the issues that I was speaking about. I think just to add to the issues that we need to take into account when we imagine, can we get compliance by 2020? So what is it required of Eskom to get compliance? So first of all, every unit, so I talked about 90 units, so at least 85 of those units, we're talking about if we retrofitted them with FGD, they would require between 120 and 150 days outages per unit. That is a little bit more possible than it was a few years ago when we were having load shedding, but it's still a significant burden on the capacity that we have available and on our responsibility to continue supplying the demand for electricity. There would be an increase in water consumption by 20% if we retrofitted all of our power stations. Based on the water availability currently, we have estimated that we could at most do an additional 2 power stations with FGD until the Lesotho Highlands scheme came into what was effected. And I know that the initial date for the Lesotho Highlands was around 2020. If my understanding is correct, that date has been moved out beyond 2023. So there is not sufficient water. If we were able to put FGD on all of our plants, there's not sufficient water to operate them currently. I've talked about the capital costs, and then there's, in total across the fleet, would be 6 billion rand per annum of operational costs added to that. I've spoken about the tariff, and I've also spoken about the CO2 emission impact. And if we can go to the next slide. So, Chair, what we did is we really, the question gets asked, why can't we implement FGD immediately and have it all implemented by 2020 when, or 2025 when our postponements come to an end? And so we did a realistic forecast of when we would actually physically be able to do FGD at all the plants. And based on that, we estimated that we would only finish the, if we started today, retrofitting with FGD, which is not possible because we still have to go through financing and procurement processes. But if it were possible, we would only finish the retrofit by 2035. And obviously, as you move the date, the start date out, that end date becomes longer. And then you can see how that then overlaps. If you can see in the blue, we have the 50-year decommissioning life. So if you assume a 50-year decommissioning life, you'll see that many of the retrofits overlap with decommissioning. And then if we assume a 60-year decommissioning life, then you can see that many of the older power stations would be decommissioned before we were able to retrofit them. If you go to the next slide. Chair, this is just the graph associated with that plan that I showed on the previous slide, and it just shows what the capital costs would be. And we're looking at it peaking in 2031, 2032 at $40 billion per annum for the retrofit program, which I think is more significant than our new build program was. And then you can see the number of days outage that would be required, and then the additional water use, how the additional water use would ramp up on a realistic program of retrofit. Okay, thank you. If you can go to the next slide. So, Chair, the next area that I'm going to cover is our ambient air quality monitoring network. I spoke about it in the introduction that we have had a monitoring network going for more than 30 years at Eskom. And you can see from this diagram that how they are distributed in the Mpumalanga area. Some of them are strategic monitoring stations, so they monitor cumulative emissions. Some of them are specific to the power station and monitor the specific emissions, ambient air quality at the power station. We see that there is compliance at all of our monitoring stations, except for there's non-compliance to the daily limit at Kumati and KwaZamakhukhule. And these are obviously from Eskom emissions, but then also from other sources. And then from a NOx perspective, there is compliance all of the time. So there's no non-compliance from an ambient air quality perspective. And then from the particulate matter, we've seen from the professor's presentation yesterday, from Dr. Eugene's presentation yesterday, and from the Department of Environmental Affairs, on the particulate matter, that's where we have non-compliance in many areas. And they are related to many contributing causes, including Eskom's emissions. Chair, I must apologize for this very outdated slide. I think the information is still relevant, and the professor actually presented a much more updated information yesterday. I think just to emphasize that we recognize completely that the impact on health is unacceptable, and we need to do whatever we can to address it. And the professor talked about indoor air pollution, I think, being seventh highest contributor. In this information from the Medical Research Council in 2008, they talked about it being but only 15th. So it seems to have moved up since this information was available. And then urban air pollution is 17th. In terms of contributing to health risk factors. I think the point of this slide is really to say there's many contributory factors. Eskom does contribute to some of that, but we need to consider, I talked about the 10% increase in the tariff, but it would only resolve 7% of the ambient air quality issue. Because there's a much more significant contribution from indoor air pollution and lower level pollution compared to Eskom's emissions. So just to emphasize that we don't for 1 minute say that that we therefore shouldn't do anything, but we're saying that the contributory from high level sources to sulfur dioxide which would result in a 10% increase in electricity tariff, you need to then start balancing out how we could best actually address the health impact, which is from lower level sources. Based on that, I'll go to the next slide, which talks about our offset program. So we really do believe that a combination and an integrated program of reducing our emissions, which I talked about, our emission plan, and an offset program combined together will be the most effective way of reducing the impact on health. We started in 2011 with an offset program, and I want to emphasize that our offset program is really focused on reducing the emissions and reducing the health impact of the communities around our Eskom power stations. So we put a lot of effort into finding the right application which will actually reduce emissions in the houses and in those areas around our power stations. We completed our pilot, which was we tested insulation, so putting ceilings in place, putting insulating walls, and an LPG, so LPG gas stove, and then also providing a heater. A lot of people ask, why don't we try renewable options, like putting solar panels on tops of roofs? What is important here is that we are trying to address the use of coal stoves in houses, because even though people are electrified, they still tend to use coal stoves for heating and cooking and use electricity for lighting. So the important aspect was to find a replacement for the coal stoves, and not and solar panels at that stage were not considered by the specialists that did that study as an appropriate replacement. So we then, I'll talk about the program. So we are now in a stage that we are doing an electricity pilot. We only piloted LPG gas stoves in the first pilot. We then went to our Eskom Exco to get approval for our application of rolling this out, and they asked us to do a pilot on electricity as well. So we'll be testing the we've tested the electricity stoves in the last in this winter. Unfortunately, the results are probably only going to be available in December this year, so I don't have any of the preliminary results from that. But that will then contribute to our decision on whether we do electrical stoves or LPG stoves or a combination of that, because there's certain complications of doing the electrical option. If you go to the next slide. So this is just showing some pictures. What we did with our offset project was, we don't want people to continue using their old coal stoves. So when we replaced it with a gas stove and a gas heater, and we did insulation in the houses, we actually supplied them with a new stove and took away their old stoves. And you can see the top picture there is the different kinds of old stoves that we took away. We also tested on the left-hand side here, we also tested a more efficient coal stove. But at the end of the study, we decided that we really need to move the communities completely away from coal, because coal has a really negative impact on their health, and we wanted to move away from that. In addition to that, there was a good uptake of the gas. The ladies talked about, when we interviewed the ladies, and the ladies do the cooking and et cetera, not only is it a cleaner option in terms of cooking, but they also talked about how much less time they spent cooking and how much easier it was for them on a daily basis to prepare food for the family. So instead of having to get this coal stove going and it takes them 2 hours, or to keep a coal stove burning throughout the day, they were able to just come into the house, switch the gas stove on, and cook. And so it wasn't just a matter of moving to a new technology. There's also, it's cleaner, but it's also better from a value point of view and a time point of view for the ladies that have to do the cooking. And they speak very emotionally about that benefit. And you can go to the next slide. And this is just pictures of the different kind of insulation. And then we also tried a Trump wall, which is painting it black and making sure that it absorbs heat and therefore increases the temperature of the house. If you go to the next slide. the lessons learned from Kwazamakhukhle. Domestic burning in Kwazamakhukhle accounts for more than 50% of the ambient fine particulate matter. So we looked at what Eskom's contribution was and what the contribution from indoor air pollution and domestic burning was. We determined that indoor air pollution would have the most impact on houses. And then that the community was very positive about the intervention. So there's a very, very positive response to the intervention. And that, I think, is very important when we go forward with the 46,000 houses in the big in the rollout, is that we have to have good uptake from the communities. We do have about 30% of households that are still in informal dwellings. SAFL presented on their solution to informal dwellings. We are still investigating that and determining what it is we can do with informal dwellings. So our plan of 46,000 houses is based on the RDP type houses and not yet on how we will address informal dwellings. So we are still looking at what the different options for that is. Let's go to the next slide. So I think also important, and I talked about how the lady said it was easier for them to come home and cook with an LPG stove compared to the coal stove. But if you look at the top graph, with the insulation, there was a 9-degree difference. You can imagine what that does on a winter's day when you're trying to get people up for work and children up for school, and from a health perspective. This 9-degree difference from the insulation, it makes the comfort of temperature a whole lot better for the people living in those houses. So we are going to implement a health assessment study while we roll out the pilots, the full implementation at Kwazamakhukhle. The Medical Research Council will be partnering with us on that, and they are going to look at how the health impacts change over the time as we implement this offset in the communities. So just to reiterate, we really are focused on the health impact and that this will benefit the communities. And we believe that the combination of all the offset measures, and there are other benefits in addition to the offsets. So somebody asked said yesterday that it's just a CSI initiative. We don't believe that it's a CSI initiative. We believe that there are actually material benefits in terms of reducing air quality, but then there's lots of other benefits that could be considered CSI benefits, but they come along with the offset program. Go to the next slide. These are just the electricity pilot that we're going to do. So people will be supplied with an electrical four-plate stove and oven, an oil heater, and then energy-efficient lighting. We found that the oil heater was not so acceptable, so from preliminary discussions from the consultants that did the pilot for us, people felt that the oil heater wasn't as effective and they wanted more like a bar heater, so we're looking for an efficient bar heater. And then there were some complications in terms of the houses not able to run a heater and a stove at the same time. So we need to look at making sure that the electrical systems in the houses can actually capacitate an electric stove and a heater at the same time. So obviously there needs to be something done to the electrical wiring in the house. Go to the next slide. This is just also showing the ceiling options. So we have tried this the spray foam, and it seems to be working. And what is beneficial of it is that it's stopping the leaks from the roofs. Not all the RDP houses were built without leaking roofs. So it stops the leaking, and then it also addresses the insulation aspects. So, Chair, that brings me to the end of my presentation. And I'd just like to reiterate that we support the minimum emission standards. I think it's just a matter of timing. And we are doing as much as we can, as quickly as we can, to address the health impacts and to bring ourselves into full compliance. We do need to have some dialogue between the different government departments. Often when we talk about SGD, the Department of Environmental Affairs is pushing us to do to come into compliance as quickly as possible, but the Department of Water and Sanitation is not keen because of the additional water use that it would contribute. We really need to get around the table with the Department of Water and Sanitation and Department of Environmental Affairs and obviously our shareholder in terms of having those tough discussions where there are trade-offs to be made from an environmental perspective. The cost-benefit analysis was raised by the professor yesterday. In our next postponement application, we will be doing a cost-benefit analysis, and we're not sure what the outcomes of that will be, but we will see from the cost-benefit analysis what comes out and then what kind of trade-offs and what kind of decisions it would influence from not only an Eskom perspective but also from a government perspective and from a NERSA perspective in terms of the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation. I thought you would address some of the issues that were raised yesterday by the CER and the professor. Because I myself was shocked by the information that it takes a condition on the loan agreement or the funding towards the construction of certain plants of Eskom to comply with the South African legislation. That those conditions were put by even institutions like the World Bank. So, which appears as if the World Bank is more worried about compliance with South African legislation than the South African utility itself. So I thought you'll respond to that, because if that is true, then it is very worrying. If Eskom is only doing the retrofit in one power station because of the condition, then it's quite worrying to me, because Eskom is a public entity, the utility that must comply, must lead by example in complying to the in complying with the South African legislation. I thought that will respond to that and the other issues that were raised about non-compliance. But I would also wanted to elaborate a bit more on the second bullet point of the second slide. Power stations generally comply with the minimum emission standards at the moment, but from 2020 we'll need to complete emissions abatement retrofits and be granted postponements to remain in compliance. Can you elaborate on this? On this one. And I think there is also an indication in one of your slides that you'll only comply to 57% by 2025. But maybe let's just use this as preliminary questions, and after answering them, we'll then go to the members.
Shall I answer, Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I can answer those questions. In terms of the FGD and the World Bank, it was accurate. The World Bank statements are accurate in terms of the pressure that they are putting Eskom under to retrofit on time at Medupi. But I must say that our atmospheric emission license requires us to comply.
What
with
license?
Our atmospheric emission license. Oh. So from a compliance point of view, we are required, in terms of the atmospheric emission license and the Air Quality Act, to retrofit Medupi on time. And it, that is a primary aspect, in our view, of ensuring compliance. It is true that we are a bit late with the Medupi FGD, and that is related to some of our procurement process, etc. But what we believe is that we may start a little later than we had originally hoped, but we would we're hoping that we will be able to pull the program forward so that we would be able to finish when we committed to finish. So the program, the units will be done within by 2025, but may only start a bit later. So I don't believe that we are being pushed just by the World Bank. The World Bank's loan is important, and if we don't comply with it, they can call on that loan, which would have significant consequences for Eskom. But it is also a condition of our atmospheric emission license, and we respect the requirement to comply. In terms of the program to implement the FGD,
what do you mean by you are not being pushed by the condition? Because we have got an Air Quality Act where the minimum emission standards have been set as a result of that act. And by 2020, all the plants must be compliant. So if it was not for the condition, Medupi will not be pushed to comply. As we see here that there are some page 3 of the documents that we have here. That you will require postponements for almost all the plans except the last 3 ones. So I don't understand that. I mean, the fact that you are required to submit an application for postponement is because the AEL says you must comply. So in the absence of complying, you then submit an application for postponement to comply. So I don't really understand that statement. If you can just clarify me on that one.
So Chair, we have always said that the requirement to meet the emission limits by 2020 would be extremely difficult for Eskom to achieve. Initially, we were constrained because we had a constrained system and we were not able to take the units out for outage. We're not as constrained as we were previously, so outages are, we would be able to get our outages. But like I indicated in the presentation, there are other constraints. So getting 300 billion to do the retrofit as we speak would be a challenge from a financial perspective. There isn't sufficient water available to operate the flue gas desulfurization plants immediately. And even with Lesotho Highlands, it would be a challenge to have sufficient water to operate FGD plants on all of the power stations. Then there is the added operational cost and also the sourcing of limestone. So while there are limits set for 2020, we currently have postponements in place up until 2025 for most of our plants for sulfur dioxide. And that's what is included into our atmospheric emission licenses. So we say that we are compliant with our atmospheric emission licenses, because we have been granted postponement. In terms of the World Bank has aligned themselves to the requirement to retrofit Medupi FGD within 6 years of the first unit being commissioned, and our atmospheric emission license aligns with that requirement. But we are required both by the atmospheric emission license and by the World Bank to comply with the retrofit by year 21-22. So although the minimum emission standards say that we must comply by 2020, we have applied in terms of the legislation for a postponement, and we've been granted that postponement. And therefore, the plan is to start with the retrofit of Medupi FGD as soon as possible. And as I said, we are not sure that we will meet the 21-22 date for the first unit, but we are hoping that based on the program we can fast track the last unit and therefore complete the full retrofit as committed to in our postponement application and agreed to in terms of our atmospheric emission license.
Are you done?
Yes, Chair.
Okay.
Chair, did you want me to answer to... I think I have answered your second question, which was related to the second statement that we generally comply, and it is related to the fact that we can't implement everything all at the same time, immediately, and that we do need to implement a phased approach in order for us to be able to have all the right resources, the capacity, etc., in our retrofit program.
Okay. Let's just get questions, if there are any. Honorable Peden, Khadebe, and Makuvel.
Thank you, Chair. I'm seeing a very disturbing picture here, and I must admit I'm extremely concerned. It's easy to say that Eskom supports the minimum emission standards, and I found this report quite flowery, but if we can just deal with a few aspects of it, and we go to page 4 of the presentation, where we see green all over the place there. Green means always comply. But if Eskom can tell us, are we complying or are they complying with relaxed emission limits, which I think they are, and then the postponement for Medupi jumps out at you, being a new plant, which you've dealt with in your summary. But let's go to page 5 over the page, and we know that multiple postponements of 2020 MESs were granted, and then the SO2, we see SO2 green, but I think that's misleading, and I want someone to prove me wrong. This almost comply 2020-25. If we can have some comment on that one. And then we turn over to page 6, where we hit with a lot of red. Red meaning postponement needed. That's post-2025. Now, we're hearing a lot of reasons why we can't do these things. Costs and water, and there are always reasons, but I would prefer to hear reasons why we have to do these things. You know, everyone's looking for further postponements after 2025 because it's all red here. And I'm not sensing the urgency. I'm not sensing the urgency and therefore the concern. I want to jump further ahead to the individual plants. And you've dealt with the FGD Medupi being the only one. And as you said, I won't repeat what you said, but I'd like to enforce what you said, is that I believe it's only because of the loan agreement that they're doing it. And there are no FGD plans for any of the others. And I'd like someone to tell this committee why there maybe are not plans to phase out some of the dirty culprits earlier. Because the earliest I can find on this thing is 2023, which is quite a long way away. And maybe someone can tell us why we can't phase out some of the older ones. And while we're talking about phasing out, has Eskom made any provision for decommissioning plants and the EIAs that precede these? Because that's quite a cost factor too. Now, taking all of this into account, I'd just like to remind the meeting, and I'd remind Eskom about, and the department, of when we had the Lekosa earlier on in the year, and this is the report from the department, and I read, in our view, the shortcomings highlighted above have resulted in the abuse of the provisions, and by extension undermines Section 24 of the Constitution of this country. Now, those are quite serious accusations from the department. Abuse, I take. So we do...
What was that?
I have the document. I can lend it to you. This is the the postponement of compliance. This is the department presentation they gave to us earlier this year. I can't remember exactly the date.
Okay.
It wasn't long ago.
Yeah, I think it was 3 or 4 months back.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but I can make the document. So that is quite a serious use of words. Now, taking everything into account, can someone tell me, and there's a delegation going to Bonn shortly to represent the country at COP23, whether these postponements put us in breach of the Paris Agreement that we signed? Because it'll be extremely uncomfortable to represent a country for the delegates that are going there and can look them in the eye when we're in breach. And I regard that as a very serious matter. If someone can explain, please.
Okay. Let's get... Or do you want to... Let's get a response. Or you want to ask? Okay. Honorable Khadev.
I'll just post two or three questions, Chairperson. Thank you. Chair, the first question I would like to pose to Eskom, have they done a feasibility study for the extension of the lifespan of the plants mentioned on the presentation or on the slides? Do they have a decommissioning plan as well as the air quality improvement plan based on the envisaged lifespan, which is going to be 6 years? The other question, Chair, which I found very disturbing, the prof from CER yesterday, Center for Environmental Rights, yesterday said that the ESCOM refused to give them access to their social economic impact assessment for early decommissioning, as well as they refuse access to monthly compliance reports, which I found very disturbing. Why did they do that? Can someone explain to this committee why did they refuse access? Because access to information is critical if we are an entity which belongs to the government and we want to run our things in a transparent and open manner. Can anyone explain? Thank you.
Okay. Let's take those two questions and then we'll come to Honorable Akwe. Yeah.
Perhaps I'm going to just hand over to Krista first to talk about the decommissioning issues, and then I'll cover some of the other questions.
To talk about the decommissioning, I think the question goes around the older power plants that the bigger polluters. We've done a study to see what's going to happen over the next 10 years in terms of our capacity requirements. And indications based on current assumptions is we're going to have excess capacity up to 6,500 megawatts on about 2022. And then with the current growth assumptions, we're going to probably run out by 2025, 2026. So the approach that we've taken is that we have started putting some of our older plants, and in particular the three less efficient plants, which is Komati, Hinduna, and Gwerfle. We started putting some of those units into cold reserve, and we've also done that from a cost perspective. The question around decommissioning is there's no decision around decommissioning. So we use, for planning assumptions, we use specific periods. So for the IRP, the previous round, the 50-year life expectancy was used. For some plants, including Kuiberg, a 60-year life expectancy is used. And that life expectancy is based on a pre-feasibility and a feasibility study that we do. So I think the question was also, have we done feasibilities on decommissioning? Yes, we have. We've done for four studies, we've done a pre-feasibility, for four power stations, we've done a pre-feasibility study to look at the possibility of life extension beyond 50 years. So that information is available. The next step is if you do indicate one of the stations to be feasible, then you will go into a full feasibility study to then understand what's required to extend the life of that power plant to 60 years or beyond. The question around provision for decommissioning, we do make financial provision for decommissioning, so it's a line item on our balance sheet. So it's a provision for decommissioning line, and that's based on the life expectancy of the power plant, as well as making certain assumptions around the cost implications of decommissioning. So all of that is provided for in our financial statements or in our balance sheet. So as we do start commissioning some of the plant, we will obviously then draw on that going forward. I think the question around access to monthly compliance socioeconomic impact studies, we obviously, you know, I'm surprised that was an issue raised yesterday. Now, I think that information is available. We've done socioeconomic impact studies on five power plants to get an indication of what the potential impact is if those power plants are in fact decommissioned, and it's got a significant impact on the communities. So that information is available, and I'm sure if we get a request, we can surely make that available. So the studies were done by a third party, so it wasn't done by Eskom, and I'm sure we can make that information available.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add to, so just to take from Krista, we received quite a few power requests. The atmospheric, the emission data, it comes to my area. The social impact assessment was done on someone else. I wasn't aware that it had been declined. So when the power requests come in, they go to the responsible department. So I've heard for the first time that it had been declined yesterday, and we can commit to look into it and see what the reason for that was. I don't know if they gave you a reason, but I'm also surprised that it was declined. In terms of the emission data, we have given the annual emission reports. I think the issue raised by Dr. Cancross was that it doesn't have sufficient data in it. But what we have done is take a note of what the Centre for Environmental Rights has raised, and we've looked at what the requirements and guidelines are for those emission reports, and we're working on improving them so that they have more detail. I think, Chair, this is probably a good time for me to answer the one question about the non-compliances that were shown at Kendall Power Station yesterday. And I talked about it in the introduction that we did have some upset conditions last year for 2% of the time. So across all our 90 units, for 2% of the time, we had some upset conditions. So if you remember the graph that was put up yesterday afternoon, it shows a month's emissions, and it shows two or three times in the month where it goes up for one day and then it's okay, it's way below the limit for a considerable amount of time, and then it spikes up again. And those spikes are caused when we perhaps have a technical fault on the unit. If we have a blockage from on the ash side, then the blockage will impact on the electrostatic precipitators. So to show that slide and say there's non-compliances, we are, in terms of our license, permitted to have, it allows for some upset conditions, and it allows us a period of time to fix those upset conditions, which is 48 hours. And you can see that from those pictures, there were no occasions on that graph that showed more than 2 days that we were above the limit. But then there were many lines in that graph that showed that we were well below the limit and operating safely below the limit. So this year, we've improved significantly. We've had 9 incidences across all our 90 units for this first half of this year, which equates to 0.2% of the time of us being operating in upset conditions, which is a significant improvement from the 2% of the previous year. So I think just to emphasize that we take it upset conditions very seriously, and we do everything we can to avoid upset conditions, but there are occasions when the plant does have conditions that impact on the emissions, and we address those when they happen as quickly as we happen. So we don't have instances where for 3 or 4 or 5 days we are sitting in non-compliance to the emission limits. It will go up for 1 or 2 days, and we do everything to bring it within the emissions. Chair, to respond to some of the first questions that were asked, there was no intention to show a wrong picture on that slide that shows lots of green. I did say when I was presenting that slide that we're showing green because we have postponements in place, but we don't have postponements in place after 2025. So I did talk to it, and there was no intention to give a false impression. But what we're saying is we are in compliance because we have been granted postponements in terms of legal process that we followed, and therefore we are in compliance. I take note of the perception that there's no urgency. I think we are committed to do this get compliance as quickly as we can, but we do have constraints. But we take note that it's not regarded as sufficient. And I think I've responded to the statements in terms of the World Bank and the FGD. So I don't want to go into to repeat myself. And I also take note in terms of Section 24 of the Constitution, which is the right to health. Everybody has the right to an environment that's not detrimental to their health. And I think that we have said on many occasions that we do recognize that our power stations have a negative impact on health, and we are working towards addressing that. In terms of the climate change aspect, no, we will not be in breach of the commitments that we've made in terms of climate change, in terms of CO2. There is I unfortunately don't have the figures off the top of my head because I don't work with them. Judy may be in a better position to answer that. But there is a peak that we get to that we will remain below, and specifically because we will be generating with more efficient power stations. The Madupi and Kasili are more efficient in terms of CO2, and before we reach that peak, it is likely that the decommissioning of some of the very older power stations will start. But we also are lower than we have been the past 2 years because we're generating less. So our CO2 emissions, our annual CO2 emissions are slightly lower than they were a few years ago.
Yeah, we'll come to the follow-ups later. You know, the reason why I think there is some frustration by the members is that yesterday we got shocking information, And the presentation today does not address that sufficiently. And I think that might be the frustration that Honorable Peden is raising. Beyond the statement that we are committed to the minimum emission standards, let me just make an example. Thuli, the National Air Quality Officer, said it is some kind of an offense to submit wrong information to the department or to the officer, National Air Quality Office. But it is an offense and there are consequences for that. Is that what you said? But Professor Kane Cross, I hope I'm pronouncing the name properly. Professor Kane Cross yesterday said the application that ESCOM has submitted for postponement is defective, meaning it's not the correct information that is submitted to the air quality officer. He said that the the atmospheric impact reports did not include health impact assessment. He made a number of points, and I'm sure you did receive the presentation yesterday. But he also said ESCOM is required to keep data and submit daily information on the emissions. And what is happening is that ESCOM is submitting monthly instead of daily. And when you submit monthly, it's difficult to determine the daily, because by law, you need to measure the emissions on a daily basis. So the submission that was done by ESCOM was defective in that sense. And the professor also made a number of important points here. And one of it was that the comparison between the model ambient concentration was only done at 3 of the 12 stations. And in these 3 cases, model annual average concentration underestimated measured values in their vicinity by 60% to 80% at the station. Yet modeling results were used to assert compliance or otherwise with air quality standards. He further says that it was also assumed that model concentrations were adequate and valid estimates of concentration for all the power stations. So I thought that you deal with this specific one, because what the professor was saying yesterday is that the basis for the approval of the postponement application on the minimum emission standard was defective, was false, not false as such, certain information was omitted, and therefore that approval should not have been made, if we follow what you are saying. I just want to get there are other points which were made as well, which I guess I must just leave them out. you know, if you are able to just respond to this one, because basically what the prof was saying is that ESCOM should not have received the approval for the extension based on the information that we received yesterday. And I would also want the department to respond to that, whether do you just make a statement to say that there are consequences for submitting wrong information, and when it's pointed out that the information was presented was incorrect, you don't do anything about it. And yet you give out a statement. So we'll come to the department. Can I just get ESCOM first?
Yes, Chair, thank you. I'm going to ask Maluta to respond to the modeling issue. But I first of all want to just talk about, Dr. Cancliffe did say that we did not give daily information, and yet the graph that he showed daily information. So I do believe that the monthly reports we give...
He says that was his own when he was averaging.
No. Our reports, and I went back and I double-checked yesterday to see one of the reports that we issue, specifically the Kendall report, and I can make a copy of it available. But we provide graphs that show every month, that show a whole month, they show every single day. They show a line across what the limit is, and they show every single day what our daily average is. The daily average is derived from emission data that we collect on a minute to a second basis. So we have continuous monitoring, which then is, I think it's averaged into a 10-minute average, which is then averaged into a daily average. However, you can go and see what the hourly emissions are as well as the daily emissions, and then you can then see what the average monthly are. But we do monitor as we're required to do in terms of the emission license. The reports that we issue on a monthly basis definitely show a daily what our daily average is. But we also have the data available, and if the department wants to see the more detailed information, they do. They get access to that if they come to site and they look at it. But it is a lot of data that would be required. But in terms of the requirements from the department of how we must put our monthly emission reports together, which does include daily information, we do meet that requirement, and the fire stations do submit that information. So I think perhaps the professor and I should have a discussion in terms of exactly what he's looking for, but I do believe we report as we're required to do in terms of the department, and perhaps the department would like to respond to that. I'd like to...
I see the professor raising his hand. Just a minute. Did we quote you incorrectly, Prof?
If I can just clarify. I, by chance, had a few of the Kendall monthly reports which came in a batch of other data sent, but I could not get monthly reports for all the power stations. So I could use those as examples of what is happening and what should be reported, but when we requested the monthly reports for all the other power stations for the period, we were refused, and the request was made through the CER.
Also, the issue is that they don't keep it, but you did not get access to them, that information. Okay. All right.
Okay, again, I will look into why it was refused.
Because
I was not aware that it had been declined.
Okay.
So I'd just like Maluta to respond to the allegation that we only included three power stations and not cumulative emissions.
Thanks, Chair. I think there was some misunderstanding in terms of the modeling process. The reason why we model is because we cannot measure everywhere in the country. So that's one of the reasons. The second reason for modeling is we want to estimate the impact of sources that do not even exist at the moment. Like if we're planning to build a facility next year, we can estimate the impact of that facility before it is even built. So what we do in modeling, I'll give you an example with the weather forecasting. It's exactly the same process. What we need to establish the confidence that what the model is giving us is realistic and we can rely on it. So what we normally see now, you get a prediction from weather service to say there's a storm coming over the Western Cape. It's a prediction of something that has not yet happened. The reason why they give confidence is because they look at what their models give them and what is measured on the ground. It doesn't mean at all times when we model, we need to compare with the observations. There's a point that I wanted to respond to that Professor raised yesterday. Dr. Khumalo indicated that in our priority areas, we have got a complex mixture of sources. So that means at any point within the priority area, there are so many sources that are contributing to the levels of pollution in that particular area. So if I'm going to use emissions from only power stations or from only from Eskom and I exclude the contribution from other sources, I do not expect to have a one-to-one agreement between my predictions and the observations. If that happens, I as a modeler will get worried, because that will mean that the contribution from other sources is zero, which is impossible. So the comparison that Prof was talking about is not always necessary. We do model validation. Model validation is just for us to know, to get an idea. Can we predict this? If yes, then in other areas where we don't have monitoring stations, because to maintain or operate one monitoring station, I think it costs close to R1 million. So, and we cannot have monitoring stations at every corner of South Africa. All we need is to have confidence in our models. If you show me the model gives realistic results, then you don't have to measure everywhere. That's all we need. So that is why there's no need for comparison everywhere. Thanks, sir. I hope I've answered, Prof. If there's a follow-up, we'll deal with that one.
Okay, and then the issue about the atmospheric impact report, which did not include health assessments. Do you want to speak to that? Or is it not an ESCOM issue?
Chair, it was a while ago that we submitted it. Can you answer that? Okay, thanks, Chair.
Okay. Julie?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Should I answer the one question, or should I just answer all the others that you said we should respond to?
Yeah, you can answer all of them.
In the initial atmospheric impact reports that were submitted, there was some information gaps, and we did request the facilities to give us additional information in data. So yes, when you look at the initial impact report, they didn't have a health impact assessment. But we made that requirement back to them, and the information was then submitted. We had quite a number of letters to all the applicants where there were information gaps where we made those requests. So I think that if you take the initial report that was submitted, of course, you will not find that information in that initial report. But in the additional information request, we were then supplied with that information. And perhaps, Chair, I can then talk about the issue around the compliance reports. The DG explained yesterday that the system for air quality management in general, we are still building it. So although we have things that work now, we have things that are still going to work better in the future. But we have the system for licensing, which will have compliance reports for all facilities. But not all the reports are available yet in that system, because we are still building it, and facilities are coming into the system over time based on the availability of resources. The other challenge that we have as a result of the legal framework of the land is that the licensing authorities are different. They are sitting different spheres of government, and they make different AL conditions. So some of the AL conditions, the license conditions, will make a requirement to submit monthly the compliance report. But some of them have made a requirement to submit quarterly, which is not uniform across the country because the licensing authorities themselves are different. So you find that discrepancy, that some facilities will have monthly data, some will have quarterly data, but as ESCOM is indicating, when we need the data, even though the AEL says quarterly, we are given that date. We see also, when you look at the modeling of the impact in the, of the facility.
But are you not able to develop a standard guideline for all the licensing authorities?
We have. But as I'm saying, at the moment, the system has been developed. The facilities are coming into the system over time. So some of the facilities are not yet in the system. They will come as their ALs become reviewed, varied, or renewed. Because it's a large number. We license over 1,000 facilities in the country. So they're not all in the system at the same time. They come in over time. And this would also affect when you look at how you will do the impact report for the facility. Because it will be submitted to the National Air Quality Officer who must work with the licensing authority. So you wouldn't submit one report for, if I can make an example, Sasol St. Vincent and Sasol Sasolbeck. Because the licensing authorities are different. So you must capture the impact of this one facility in its full extent where it stays. So I think just that understanding of how the system wants us to manage this in its entirety. But Chair, I would just, while I have the opportunity, talk about one of the, maybe two of the points that ESCOM made. It's difficult for us to sit with big numbers around cost of compliance, when we know the impact on the environment. So we want a fully-fledged cost-benefit analysis. Yes, it might cost us 20 rand to comply, but what is the benefit of that? What if the benefit is 100 rand? Do we really need to complain then about 20 rand cost of compliance? Those are some of the discussions that should be held. And in that regard, when Deirdre was saying we need a discussion between DOE, DA, and DPE to address the ESCOM issues, I would say that National Treasury also needs to be part of that discussion because it might cost, but what are the externalities for that? If we don't come into compliance, how much then are we spending on the health budget as a result of the non-compliances that we sit with? It needs to be, you know, a fully-fledged discussion that will take us to what are the benefits of this compliance besides looking at what it is costing us as a country, because it is costing us far more in terms of the health index, livelihoods of the people and the future generations that we want to see in this country. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Mokubela, your questions have been asked and answered.
Yes, true, Chair. they have, so you were a bit unfair, but it's fine. because we achieved the same purpose. Like the very one that Dr. Khumalo referred to about the water issues and so on. I think I'll leave that one immediately. Chair, they remain, but let me start here. Firstly, just to understand whether in the stakeholders forums where you have got bodies that sit and they interact with these kind of issues, including communities and so on, those that are run by Sasol and ESCOM, don't we have a situation where CER sits in those meetings or their posture is sort of investigative kind of posture or manner in which they deal with you, or they are allowed to sit in those meetings so that some of the things do not have to wait until we are in a platform that is created by Parliament, but you can then be able to interact even before you come here and you are able to reconcile some of the issues, ideas, assist each other, enrich one another so that we are able to achieve the purpose for which Parliament seeks to achieve, because you can do that without being assisted by Parliament. But I'm just trying to find out whether they sit in those meetings. The second point, Chair, CR did indicate that probably we need to look at the dust monitoring regulations. Is it monitoring or... to say we need to tighten the dust regulations and so on, which they believe they don't give accurate measurements and so on and so on. Perhaps it's an area we should be able to look at, particularly around mining areas, because indeed there's a lot of dust there, and I think they contribute a lot to some of the problems. But the issue I wanted to raise, which again, whether I'll say it's an allegation or what, Eskom did talk to the 300 billion that is the cost of them complying, 57% compliance.
100%.
400%. Probably, I think, yes, I remember on their slide, it's like that. If that for total, if as in today, that's what you said. But the point I wanted to raise, I think CR might have got it wrong in this one. So CR talks about you having been able to have, through the technologies that we are using now, having achieved massive sort of savings to the tune of your capex about 107 billion, and in terms of operational expenditure to the tune of 1.8 billion. Are you able to confirm that, whether indeed that is the case, and where are these savings going, if then you're remaining with that argument now? The third point, Chair, I take your explanation in terms of the lifespan of these facilities to be tricky, in terms of your explanation now or today, that you are not necessarily looking, and I agree, not that I'm totally opposed to it, but I'm saying at some point we need to be able to know what is exactly the lifespan. Because if you then say you're looking at 50, 60 years, and that is not just for productivity, but you are also projecting in those years what will be the supply and demand, it means then we must rely already on missing. Or whatever the mess of the market, we can't necessarily take decisions. We can't be sure what is going to happen. As in today, it will be very difficult for us to push you to say this is what is supposed to happen, because we will be then saying we'll be studying the markets then and so on and so on. We need some certainty to say you are working on 50 or 60 years lifespan as per this particular facility, so that our decisions are around that. Whatever we do, our interactions with you must be based on that one. The last but one, Chair, the offset, both for Sasol and Eskom. I haven't seen or got to understand what informs your budget on offset. Is there a particular requirement that perhaps, or some proportion to your budget to say you must spend 5% or so much of your budget on offsets, or you just choose the amount, it's at your own discretion, to say you can this year spend 5 million or 10 million or 100 million, what informs that particular budget? On which basis do you then say, either we are going to be building houses or we are going to be doing this or that? And in fact, as you were saying, some of the houses, let's say RDP houses for argument's sake, which are not built by you, human settlement is involved. and perhaps they are not as appropriate or suitable to some of your technologies and so on, probably you may need to interact with them, with human settlements, so that future housing projects that they build are sort of in line with what you expect. You know, I'm just saying, well, we may not have offsets forever. I think it's a temporary measure or intervention, but it's useful that they don't build houses, let's say, next year, and you want to come with an offset project that is not in line or appropriate or a bit relevant to the housing that they do. So you may need to interact with them as well. My very last chance, I said that, that was last part one. Whether you... No, yes. English allows that.
Don't give them numbers. This is the first or the second and the last. Just
no,
now.
No. The last one, sir. The last one. Are all your monitoring stations, ESCOM and SASOL, functional? Are all of them efficient and effective? Can we rely on them? Because those of government often were told they are not functional, so many, and so on. Are yours running almost every day, giving accurate results that we expect, or you have got challenges? Can you share with us if in that particular regard? And I'm seeing both of them, both ESCOM and
yeah.
ESO. Thanks.
All right.
Okay. Follow-up, so let's take the follow-ups. Brief.
I'll be very brief, Chairperson. I couldn't agree more with the remarks that were echoed by Dr. Khumalo. That's why initially I posed the question about the air quality improvement plans, because we really need to have a cost-benefit analysis for the full to determine the full compliance. What does it mean to have a full compliance with the minimum emission standards? Whether, like he mentioned, I won't even do a service, because she put it quite correctly. That's what I wanted to do a follow-up on, because that's the reason why I wanted to know. If they've done the feasibility study, what impact would it have in the what are the plans they will have in improving the quality, to improve air quality? That was critical for me to hear, that they've also done the financial planning, but they've also looked in the improvement of air quality in that particular area. That's why I posed that question. Coupling that, Chairperson, with slide 13, Chairperson, we heard yesterday from CER, according to them, there was a suggestion by African Bank, South African Development Bank or World Bank mission, which suggested that ESCOM need to adopt a direct finance limestone injection program to limit the SO2 emissions at Medupi and other stations. According, I presume that would have cost far less than $300 billion that is mentioned on the slide. Why do they don't implement the suggestion by the mission? I would like to hear from their side, Chairperson, why they don't implement this suggestion by the mission of the World Bank. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. I didn't hear any response from the department to what they referred to when they spoke of abuse of provisions. If someone can answer that one. And then in terms of the Paris Agreement, sadly the economy not growing is helping us on greenhouse on CO2 emissions. But at the same time, we have the controversial Tabametsi climate assessment. What did the headline read? Reveal staggering greenhouse emissions. And, you know, we know that the court confirmed that climate change impact assessment is needed. So if someone can give us an update on that, because that seems to be taking, well, if it comes into effect, as is, taking us backwards So Tabamezi is a big question as far as greenhouse emissions. The other question, Deirdre, I don't know, if, I think it was you. You mentioned water, there's enough water to do FGD, the flue glass desulfurization. An additional 2 units until the Lesotho Highlands scheme comes up. So is that additional to Kendal and Matimba, or is that referring to Kendal and Matimba? Because if you can do another 2, surely that could hasten the decommission of non-performing older units that are culprits. Thank you. Those are my 3.
Is that all? Okay, I hear new questions more than follow-ups, but it's fine. Let's deal with that. The Tabamezi one, we dealt with it, Honorable Pedder. Remember, it was handled separately. There was a court case challenging the decision to grant environmental authorization. The court said there must be a climate change impact assessment that must be conducted, which I think the minister and the department are dealing with that one now. So I don't want to put anybody here under difficulty in answering that question. But I see Judy's raising her hand. Maybe she wants to respond.
Chair, I think the question that the Honourable previously also raised was how does life extension or life expansion to 60 years impact our Paris commitments? And the fact is that if we extend to 60 years, of course, we don't have any clarity from Eskom as to really what the plan is. But our calculations were on the basis of a 50-year lifespan for all power plants. So our calculations in terms of the carbon budget and our commitment over for the Paris nationally determined contribution was on the basis of 50-year lifespan of Eskom power plants. So this 60-year brings in a whole new
dimension. So the 60-year, it's an extension, or it's what Eskom is proposing now?
Well, from Deirdre's presentation, what we saw was that there is a proposal for some of the power plants not to be decommissioned at the end of 50 years, but to be decommissioned at the end of 60 years. And that has an impact not only in terms of air quality, but also in terms of CO2 emissions. And our carbon budget was on the basis of a 50-year lifespan.
Okay.
And it was a decommissioning program that we received from Eskom. It was a decommissioning program that was annexed to the Integrated Resource Plan.
Mm.
Chair, if you'd like me to go the next step in terms of the carbon budget and how we calculated and the question of Tabamezi, I can also add to that. Not necessarily on the impact assessment part, but on the integrated resource plan.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So essentially what we did, we have calculated a carbon budget that is inclusive of the coal-fired power stations that we have on the Integrated Resource Plan 2010. And there was an inclusion of a certain number of megawatts for independent power producers, coal-independent power producers, not renewables. I'm talking about coal-independent power producers. So we were using the policy instrument at our disposal, which was the 2010 IRP. Of course, there is work by the Department of Energy on the integrated resource plan now. So the policy position is that South Africa's transition to a lower carbon economy includes a mix of energy sources, and coal is still part of that mix. However, we need to transition out of dirty power sources and into cleaner power sources. And it's that question of transitioning, and it's the question of the extent to which we are building in the capacity to reduce our emissions over time. And so any kind of adjustments of additional coal going into the future is indeed going to affect our commitments. Or additional coal or life extension is going to affect our commitments.
Okay. Can we get responses? Maybe you must come last. Let's get ESCOM and then department.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the savings that Centre for Environmental Rights referred to yesterday, and I stand to be corrected on the exact numbers. I can go back and check. But our original budget to do fabric filter retrofits at all of our power stations, if I recall correctly, was around 80 billion. And ESCOM is obviously our CFO has asked us for savings. So we sat together with the engineers and ourselves, and we looked at, well, what other options could we do which wouldn't cost as much but would then still achieve the limits. So we then went and we looked and we said only Tutuka and Creole will have fabric filter retrofits. The other power stations, and I think it's on one of the slides, will have high-frequency transformers, and we would upgrade and refurbish the electrostatic precipitators. So that then brought the cost down from around the 80 billion to 63 billion. So it's not a significant amount of money in the bigger picture aspect. And so it was a saving on ESCOM, which we required in order to remain financially sustainable. So those savings didn't go anywhere else. They were savings that we contributed to the overall ESCOM for financial sustainability. So that was the savings that I referred to, but really, you know, as a company, we needed to show some savings. There is a slight bit of risk around the other technologies, but all of our tests so far have shown that the high-frequency transformers and refurbishment of the ESPs will achieve the 50 milligram limit that we have committed to. On the offset budget, do you want to come in? On the offset budget, I think the offsets, we're still learning what's going to work, what is an effective offset for air quality. So with this round, we were required by the authorities to implement offsets around all of our power stations. So the cost, which is 4.2 billion that we will be spending on the offset project on 46,000 houses, is based on that. We went out, we looked at how many houses on the area around the power stations, and we allocated certain houses to certain power stations, and based on that we put our offset plan together, and the cost was therefore based on what that plan would cost us.
What is the cost? How much?
4.2 billion.
That you have planned?
That we've planned, and it will be executed over the next 8 to 9 years. So if I recall correctly, we must have completed it by 2025. So we will spend that money in this period in the areas around the power stations. So currently it wasn't based on a percentage. It was based on we did the plan first and then we costed the plan. The issue on the lifespan of the plants, and we have the mercy, we do need certainty, and I think Judy spoke to that certainty being brought into the integrated resource plan in terms of when we will decommission. But it seems that there's still other aspects that get taken into account around when exactly you would close certain power stations. And I think historically, if we go back to when our other power stations were closed 20 years ago, there was no decision to close stations, and then very suddenly, within a period of 6 months, a decision was made to close, I think, about four of our very old power stations and mothball the ones that were eventually returned to service. So I think in the ideal world, you can make an estimate that it would be 50 years, but in some cases it could be sooner than that, in some cases it could be later than that. Do you want to add?
Gee, let me just add in terms of the life expectancy of power stations. As Deirdre has indicated, we're obviously dependent on the integrated resource plan around what is required, also from an Eskom perspective around new build and capacity coming online. So we are busy with the latest revision of the IRP, and all of these considerations will be taken up in the new revised IRP. The last one was done in 2010, and as I've indicated, we have to use a specific lifespan or life assumption to do planning on. So that's why we originally used 50 years. What we then do is, as we get closer, we do what we call a pre-feasibility study to indicate whether it might be feasible to extend the life of the power plant, depending on what the IRP requires, beyond 50 years. And if the pre-feasibility indicates that it is feasible, then we'll go into a full feasibility, which in fact is what we've done for Coburg Power Station. And currently the life expectancy for Coburg is 60 years. We've done, as I said, the pre-feasibility on four of the fleet of the 13 power stations that's in full commission. It obviously indicates to us which of the stations would be feasible for extending life. But it really is an input into the integrated resource plan. So we're currently busy with that. I think it's planned to be issued early in the new year. And, obviously subject to what's coming out of that resource plan, we will then have to plan accordingly. I think the bottom line is, at this stage, we're not planning to decommission any power stations. I think there's also a requirement from NERSA to dispatch our units on least cost basis. So typically your older stations are less efficient and more costly to operate, apart from the fact that they also, in terms of the air pollution, has got the bigger impact. So we would therefore, based on that provision, we would then start putting some of the older units, what we call, into cold reserve, if not required. And therefore we have a number of units at Komati currently in cold reserve. We have a few units at Grootvlei Power Station in cold reserve, and also at Indrina. And as we proceed, and obviously as the Medupi and Kasuli units come online, I think as indicated by the honourable member that we will require less of the older stations, we will obviously take those units out into what we call cold reserve or reserve storage for a longer period. But I think the risk that we run is without a confirmed integrated resource plan, and even once that's done, I mean, we need to have certainty that the planned units that's planned for future will come online as planned. And if they don't come online, obviously we need to, as Eskom, make provision for that, to have that capacity as a backup, to compensate maybe for units that come online later. I think that's where we stand with that.
Yeah, there's still a bit of uncertainty around the integrated resource plan. We were briefed on it sometime this year, and by the Department of Energy, of course. And we were promised that the plan will be ready by August. And as you know, that there was an announcement by the former minister Kubai, that the plan will be finalized by January, February next year. Now I'm told that has since been revised. It's going to be done before the end of this year. So we will get some certainty as soon as it is done. But of course, as everybody knows, that the contest around that is not much of what the plan is supposed to be. To be providing certainty around, especially around the energy requirements of the country and how we're supposed to meet those requirements. And the policy that was introduced in 2010 of a mixed different sources of energy from coal, from renewable, from all other sources. Now the concentration, the focus is around nuclear, which is something that has just caught the attention of many people. But we do agree that the integrated resource plan is necessary, it's very urgent, and it's going to provide certainty around the what the country will do going forward, because we have to live up to the commitments of the Paris Agreement, and we need that plan. We need it to guide us going forward. Tuli wanted to say something. I just wanted to close now.
Thank you, Chair. The response to Honorable Padman's question around us as a department saying there's an abuse of the postponement provisions. The intention for the postponement provisions was to give transitional arrangements for existing plans to be given time to come into compliance with the ambient with the minimum emission standards. And what we are seeing now is a rolling postponement, which was never the intention of the clause. So that's what we mean when we say there is an abuse of the postponement clause. It was supposed to be you are still in the process of getting into compliance. Maybe it's taking a bit longer for your technology to be installed or to be delivered in the country, depending what the case may be. But you will come to compliance at a future date, which at the moment is not in all cases how the clause is being applied. And the reality, Chair, is that for some of the facilities, the only solution is to decommission them and get them out of the system. That is a fact when it comes to having to come into compliance, and it needs a further discussion. And as a department, we are looking into that on how to best avoid the seemingly evident abuse of the postponement clause. Thank you.
Yeah?
I think just to add a real expression of deep concern, because South Africa's policy framework includes very centrally in it, including our national development plan, the transition to a lower carbon and cleaner economy. And really what we hear from Eskom is very little signal of any kind of forward movement and creative thinking. And we just also need to be reminded that the World Bank provided funding for a CSP plant, concentrated solar power pilot plant. That funding, as far as we understand, has not been utilized. And the reason for that funding was to help Eskom to start moving into and go into an experimentation mode of moving into alternative sources of power. I think the lack of clarity that we hear from Eskom is really undermining a fundamental part of South Africa's sustainable development policy-making framework. Thanks.
I share that concern. In fact, it's a point that I was going to make now when I close. I share that concern 100%. Because it is almost at the center of the posture and the attitude by Eskom to South Africa's legislative regime and policy intentions. I'm going to cite two examples. When we had an engagement with Eskom, we called Eskom the chairperson, the then chairperson Guano, came to our meeting with the CFO, I guess. The CFO is still suspended, Anon Singh. Brian Molefe was not there that day. We got an apology. We engaged with them around the renewable energy because we were worried about the stance that they were taking. Because renewable energy, the independent power producer program on renewable energy, is part of our energy mix. It's part of the things that we need to do in order to advance what why do I forget your name? Judy. What Judy is talking about, a transition to a lower carbon economy. And, you know, the attitude we get is that Eskom is not willing to live up to the commitment and the expectation of the entire country towards that, because they were refusing to sign the next commitment of renewable, the procurement program of the renewables. And I believe there's still some issues around that. So we were sensing that we are going to have a problem here because we have got a utility that is not willing to change its mindset, to look at things in the future the way all of us in the country are looking at them. We're still struggling there. We're supposed to have a follow-up. We have not had a follow-up with the leadership of Eskom. And I don't want to blame you guys because you may not be at the level where decisions have been made. We're talking about Eskom as a utility. The second example is on this minimum emission. Now, you have got legislation, Air Quality Act, that was promulgated in 2010, the minimum emission standards was effective 2015. So we've got legislation that has been in effect for almost 7 years now. Up to today, we're still talking about rolling postponements, because basically what Eskom is saying to us is that we will keep on making applications and those applications are going to be approved. Basically, it says that you have to approve the applications that you are going to submit. And if you don't approve, you know there will be a crisis in the country about energy, about electricity. Now, that is a very bad attitude. Because once legislation has been enacted, you must then prepare to comply with the legislation. Look at all the costs. I don't buy an argument that is too costly. We can't comply with it. We know from experiences out there on how Eskom deals with its own governance issues that there is a lot of waste, a whole lot of waste of resources. I mean, whether you talk about the trillion deal, you talk about all other things, all other procurement programs that are there in Eskom, they don't promote efficiency, operational efficiency. There's a lot of waste, there's a lot of corruption there, and yet we are told that things cannot be done, which will help this country. They can't be done because there's no money. It's really bad. I mean, now we know that there is 1.6 trillion billion that was paid, not trillion, billion, that was paid to trillion. I nearly say 1.6 trillion. It was paid to trillion, a company called Trillion, for work that was there was no value that was derived out of the payment of that. And yet we are able to say, no, it's going to cost us a lot of money for us to comply with South African legislation. I mean, that for me really represents a very bad and an arrogant stance and posture by the utility. And I think at some point we need to convene the board and the senior management to come and talk to them about compliance with minimum emission standard. We can't accept the rolling postponements. We just can't. I mean, 57 compliance. You see, I understand about this SO2 that you really need to find some kind of a solution to it. And I think both the department, ESCOM and SASOL, must sit around the table, see how we find an acceptable technological solution. Because it does appear that solving it through this other means may also create some other environmental problems. So that is an area that I think must just be discussed and find a solution. But any other thing, I think there must be compliance. I think we must take an attitude and a posture that says no further postponement post 2025. I'm saying that may be the attitude. Of course, we still need to converse it with everybody and discuss with the department as well. Because this thing, it looks like it's going to be abused, this postponement, really. It looks like it's going to be abused. It was not the intention, but now it has been made a rule rather than an exception. And I think the message that we must carry, the ESCOM delegation, is that the portfolio committee is not happy about this. It's not very happy about the orientation of ESCOM to comply with legislation. If this one, I mentioned the other one about the energy mix, the program on renewable energy, which ESCOM is blocking, and now there is an indication that there are some power plants which you intend to run beyond the expected date of decommissioning. So I think that is our message that we want to send on this one. But of course, I think we'll have an engagement again with the department on this SO2. What will be the solution on the SO2? Are you ready, Groundwork?
I am, thank you. We can start from the beginning.
Hey, Honourable Parent, sorry. I saw your hand. You still want to ask the question?
No, you summed up everything.
Oh, 2 minute break, okay. 2 minutes body break.